It's Diane. On my mind, today's Republican Party.
The dominant wing of the party made common cause again and again with the forces of extremism, paranoia, bigotry, tribalism, and you can see it through the 50s, through Goldwater, through Nixon cutting a deal with segregationists, to Ronald Reagan and the New Right and the religious right, up through the Tea Party and to Trump today.
David Corn is a veteran reporter who's watched the evolution of politics in Washington for decades. In a new book, he argues the extremism that led to January 6th can be traced back at least 70 years and outlines a series of deliberate choices by the GOP to nurture and exploit fear and loathing. His book is titled American Psychosis. David, you start the book with an anecdote about the 1964 Republican convention. Tell us what happened there and why you think this is seminal.
In 1964, the Republican Party had a very, very stark choice to make when it came to picking its presidential nominee. There was Nelson Rockefeller, who was a moderate Republican, some called him a liberal Republican, but, you know, he wanted a tighter budget, but he also wanted the government to make the New Deal work better. And he wanted investments in education and infrastructure and also greater spending on defense. On the other side was Barry Goldwater. He was the prophet, the hero of what was then a new and rising conservative movement, partly led by William Buckley, who was running a magazine called National Review. And he was a libertarian out of the West from Arizona. He was opposed to civil rights legislation, federal government intervening in people's personal affairs, such as he would call integration and trying to combat segregation. He wanted to get rid of the New Deal social programs and wanted a much more confrontational approach with the Soviet Union. In fact, he talked about even the use of nuclear weapons in Vietnam and other places. So that was sort of the framework. Goldwater won the nomination, not by a lot, but he won in part because he had as foot soldiers the John Birch Society. The John Birch Society had been formed a few years earlier by a guy named Robert Welch, who was, I think it's fair to say, a loony conspiracy theorist who thought that Eisenhower was a communist agent, who thought that the commies had gotten into every PTA, every union, took control of book review sections of magazines and newspapers, and was basically totally running the U.S. government. You know, he wasn't worried about a couple spies here and there. The commies were everywhere. The Reds were everywhere. That was his mission. That's what he set up the John Birch Society to do. And it fueled this, you know, and took advantage, exploited the paranoia that was out there during these Cold War times. So the Birchers were a key component of Barry Goldwater's campaign. That was something that Nelson Rockefeller tried to use against Barry Goldwater, and other moderate and liberal Republicans were upset about that. They felt the party was being taken over by extremists. So at the 1964 convention, when it was clear that Goldwater had enough delegates to win, the moderates, Nelson Rockefeller and a few others, made one last stand. And that was to try to pass a party platform plank that basically condemned the extremism of the Communist Party, the Ku Klux Klan, and the John Birch Society. And when Nelson Rockefeller got up to speak in favor of this, he was not just booed and shouted down. People threw things at him. Reporters who were there thought the crowd was actually going to get violent. And it was sort of a mob reaction. Hundreds, if not thousands, of Republicans were taking the side of extremists and shouting down Nelson Rockefeller. There was tremendous hatred in the air, according to the accounts that are there. And you can actually watch a small clip of this on YouTube these days, so you can see it for yourself. The amendment, the platform plank, was voted down rather soundly and loudly. And the, you know, the convention moved on to Barry Goldwater's address the next night, or was it two nights later, in which he said extremism and the defense of liberty is no vice. So there he was, having been criticized by his own party members and roundly in the political media of having exploited and used extremists to get the nomination, now defending extremism. So it was a real, as I said, it was a mob mentality in defense of extremism. And I start the book with that because I do think there is a line from that moment to January 6th. It's not a straight line. It zigzags a bit here and there. But the premise of the book is that for over 70 years, the Republican Party has encouraged and exploited far-right extremism. And you saw it in the 64 contest. You saw it earlier with McCarthyism. And you saw it with Donald Trump. So it's been a very consistent part of the party. Donald Trump didn't start this. He didn't invent this. And it wasn't, you know, it hasn't always totally defined the party. But I do think it's a dark side of the party's history that has not been fully acknowledged and often undercovered by the media.
Actually, you go all the way back to the founding of the Republican Party. And the 100 years afterwards, there was this struggle between the two sides.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The party was founded in 1854, basically because a bill had passed in Congress that made it possible for slavery to expand to the Western territories and states that were then being settled by Americans. The party didn't, it included abolitionists, but its stance wasn't against ending all slavery immediately, but it wanted to stop slavery because it believed as slavery spread to other parts of the growing United States, it would give slave owners a lot more economic power and political power. And that, you know, if you were a, now this refers only to white men, but if you were a white guy wanting to move west and get a farm and be an entrepreneur and start your own business, so to speak, it'd be impossible to do that and compete with plantations where labor was free. So a lot of this was an economic argument, and a lot of it was to prevent the people who controlled the slave trade in the South from spreading their economic power. So that was the premise. It was to fight for freedom to a certain extent, but also fight for economic opportunity for low-income, middle-income Americans. Again, white men, that's what we're talking about. And as the party under Lincoln, when he was elected in 1860, got power, it took other steps to expand economic opportunity. And it created free colleges for agriculture. It built harbors and worked on what we now would call infrastructure to help create economic prosperity. I mean, it was very much a progressive party. And in the years afterwards, about a century or so, the party soon after the Lincoln years developed this internal conflict between interests that were aligned with business, Wall Street, we think of Republicans now as Wall Street pro-corporate America, but there was the progressive strain remained, and you can think of Teddy Roosevelt wanting to beat back corporate power and beat back the influence of money in politics and also put some regulations on businesses when it came to food safety, labor standards, and such. And that struggle went back and forth for a couple of decades. And then Teddy Roosevelt lost. He essentially lost that fight. And from the 1920s on, the party was identified more with the interests of money. And, they you know, make the argument that they thought that was good for all Americans. Yeah, you can give them that. But that wing won.
I love the quote you use from Theodore White. He described the GOP this way, quote, "The Republican Party, to be exact, is twins and has been twins from the moment of its birth. But the twins who inhabit its name and shelter are Jacob and Esau, fratricidal and not fraternal twins. Within the Republican Party are combined a stream of the loftiest idealism and a stream of the coarsest American greed."
I love that quote too, which is why I use it. Teddy White was one of the great veteran political journalists in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And I thought that summed this up so well. I could not say it better. So I took his words to describe this duality within the Republican Party. But I do think the balance of power certainly shifted to what he called the coarsest wing that was driven by greed. That certainly shifted, you know, in the 20s and then after the World War II. And where I really pick up the story is starting with McCarthyism in the 50s, about how that wing, the dominant wing of the party, made common cause again and again with the forces of extremism, paranoia, bigotry in certain instances, and tribalism. And you can see it through the 50s, through Goldwater, through Nixon cutting a deal with segregationists, to Ronald Reagan and the New Right and the religious right, up through the Tea Party and to Trump today.
But what about FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt?
Well, he, you know, not a Republican, and he, in some ways, he almost killed the Republican Party. He was, you know, that popular, and his programs were that popular in the 30s and into the 40s, that at one point the Republicans were so beaten, they had maybe 18 senators left, and they were a tremendous minority in the House. And they kept trying to find ways to beat FDR. They called him evil. They called him a dictator. They were anti-Semitic attacks on him, even though he wasn't Jewish. And towards the end of the war, the Republicans tried to hold hearings to suggest that FDR knew that Pearl Harbor was about to be attacked and did nothing because he wanted an excuse to enter the war. This is really kind of the beginning of the Republicans weaponizing conspiracy theory. There was no truth to this, and there was a great memo written by a Republican consultant that said at that time, if we don't succeed in doing this and tarring FDR this way, our party may be no more. They thought this was their last hurrah, and it didn't work. The hearings went nowhere, and the public didn't pick up on this. But that consultant was wrong, because very shortly after the war, the Republicans picked up on a grander conspiracy theory. And that was what we'd come to call McCarthyism, that the Democrats were in league with the communists. They were communist dupes. They were working with the communists. They were allowing communists to take over portions of the U.S. government. And it was a young congressman named Richard Nixon who really started this going with the Alger Hiss case and made that case much bigger than the story of one American diplomat, and whether he had or had not been part of a Russian spy ring in the 30s, not at the time, but in the 30s. And he made it into this cultural war between good Americans and bad Americans, Republicans and Democrats. But he, you know, was outdone, outshined by Joe McCarthy, who came along and in a famous speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, before the Ladies Republican Auxiliary Club there, said he had a list of 206 communists who were in the State Department at that moment in time who were allowed to, you know, run the U.S. government. And that was a lie. He didn't have that list, but that gave Republicans what they saw was a winning issue. It fed on the unease that a lot of Americans had with the Cold War and the rise of the nuclear, you know, rise of nuclear terror. And, you know, a lot of people latched onto this, and the Republican Party saw McCarthy winning elections and helping other Republicans win elections, and they saw this was their ticket.
But now, David, we've been talking completely about what Republicans have done. What about Democrats along the way? Surely they did not just sit back and let this happen. Didn't they have their own weapons of use, weapons of demagoguery, weapons of accusations? Didn't they engage in the same way to a certain extent that Republicans did?
I think overall the answer is not really. I think there has been an asymmetry between the parties on this front. Now, there certainly were a handful of Democrats who were anti-communists, anti-Reds, and who went along with all that in the 50s. That's pretty obvious. In fact, they started the House Un-American Committees, was first run by a Democrat in the early 40s. But if you look at sort of the top line messaging, and we can stay with McCarthy for a moment, but I can bring this up much closer in time. McCarthy in 51 went to the Senate floor and said there was a conspiracy so immense, perhaps the biggest conspiracy in the course of human affairs, in the entirety of human history. And that was this conspiracy of Americans trying to undo America and subvert it so the Russians can take over. And he named George C. Marshall, who was Army Chief of Staff in World War II, helped win the war, who ran the Marshall Plan that helped save Europe, and who at this point in time was Secretary of Defense for Harry S. Truman. He named George C. Marshall as the leader of this conspiracy. He didn't say that Marshall was wrong. He didn't say that his policies were not right for America and would give the Soviet Union advantage.
Just said he was...
He was part of a conspiracy. And he said, it's hard to believe that elites would destroy their own country. But that has happened time and time again in human history. And I don't think you can find a comparable example of anything like that on the Democratic side, where a prominent Democrat who then is lionized by his party claims that the other side is, you know, has engaged in this sort of gigantic treasonous conspiracy. And if you go through the years, I think what happens is I see Republicans and the right, the far right and conservatives, again and again and again, saying that Democrats and liberals are enemies and that they want to destroy America. Not that they're wrong, not just that their policies will be bad for the nation, but they actively want to take away America from you Americans and abolish it in some ways. And you can see that with the rise of the new right and the religious right in the late 70s that Ronald Reagan embraced. You know, this is where sort of paranoia met mass media, in that back in those days it was direct mail. But a man named Richard Viguerie pioneered this device of sending out letters to conservatives to raise money for conservative groups. And if you go back and look at these notes, they're all doom and gloom and saying that the liberals are atheists and they're all tied in with the gays and they're un-American and they want to destroy America. It gets even more harsh in that you had members and leaders of the moral majority saying that homosexuality was a capital punishment, that according to the word of God, you could execute gay people. And Ronald Reagan embraced Jerry Falwell and the moral majority, despite them saying this. I don't think you can find an example of a Democratic presidential candidate or Democratic president embracing a part of the left that is out there advocating the execution of Americans for, you know, their orientation or lifestyle decisions, whatever you want to call it.
And so then how did Ronald Reagan help move those radical ideas into the mainstream?
Well, that's a great question, because earlier we were talking about the duality within the Republican Party. And, you know, when Barry Goldwater lost, it looked like the conservative wing of the Republican Party was demolished. But Ronald Reagan almost single-handedly saved it. And not necessarily when he was elected president in 1980. It was when he was elected governor of California in 1966. He was as extreme in his pronouncements and his relationships with far-right fanatics when he was a political activist in California in the early 60s.
Give me an example.
Well, he had attacked Medicare as socialism and the end of American freedom. And he said that, if we pass bills like this, America will not exist by 1980. And he also worked with a lot of groups that were Berkshire-like, that were calling for literally the execution of Supreme Justice Warren, who they didn't like because of his decisions regarding civil rights. So he was hanging out with Berkshire groups and making these very extreme pronouncements. He ran in 66 for governor, and the Democrats tried to make him out to be another Barry Goldwater. Goldwater had been demolished electorally, and they thought that would work. But Reagan had the charm, the wit, the personality, plus he had external events on his side. Between 64 and 66, there had been the Watts riots in L.A., which freaked out a lot of Americans, a lot of Californians, and it looked like society was becoming chaotic. There was the rise of the anti-war movement. There was the rise of Black Power. There was the rise of the sexual liberation movement, women's liberation. He attacked the rioters. He attacked the student protesters in Berkeley. And he made them out to be the extremists. And he won so big in 66, he took a lot of union votes, blue-collar, white, middle-class votes that had always gone to the Democrats. And he put a different face on Republican extremism. And it took him 14 years to become president. But when he was elected in 1980, it was the triumph of the conservative wing of the party. And all these groups, the Berkshires were not that big at that point in time, but there were still a lot of far-right groups raising money, claiming that the Democrats were atheists and wanted to take God out of American life, and that they were traitors, that they were in league with the Russians. I mean, really, the stuff that you see on Twitter today, but this was through direct mail. And he embraced all those groups. Those people got jobs within his administration. He sent emissaries to their conferences. And as I said earlier, he welcomed Jerry Falwell, even though his fellow moral majority officials were calling for the execution of gay people. So he kind of solidified the embrace of the far right and the victory of the conservative wing within the Republican Party, and made it all seem kind of kosher. And he would not have won without the support of the Christian right, according to pollster Lou Harris of the day. He said he would have lost by a point or two had the Christian right not swung all the way as being very much in favor of Jimmy Carter in 76 to loving Ronald Reagan in 1980. Move it forward, a couple of decades, and you can even go up to say, let's go up to the Tea Party in 2008 and 2009. The Tea Party had rallies, and again its leaders said that they believed Barack Obama was born in Kenya, was a secret socialist, who had a secret plan to bankrupt and destroy the U.S. economy so he can impose a totalitarian state. This was not just people talking at home. This was at rallies held publicly. This was Glenn Beck every night on Fox News. And who would be his guest on those shows? John Boehner, Sarah Palin, all sorts of high-level Republicans validating him.
Don't forget Rush Limbaugh.
And Rush Limbaugh was, you know, was echoing the exact same thing. And again, I would sort of flip it. Has there ever been Democrats who have gone on, you know, shows that said that George H.W. Bush or George W. Bush had a secret plan to impose a totalitarian state on America? Now, there are people, of course, on the left who would come up with those ideas, but Nancy Pelosi, Michael Dukakis, you know, Bill Clinton, they never said those things. They never made an alliance with those people. There was a rally in 2009, I believe, that Michelle Bachmann helped create. She was a Republican representative who spread a lot of conspiracy theories, that was to sort of show opposition to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. And it was held on the steps of the Capitol. And, you know, it was a Tea Party event. And they, while they were there, the crowd was shouting about the Democrats. Nazis, Nazis, Nazis. Now, we're having an argument these days about who calls someone else a fascist. But anyway, they were shouting Nazis. Who was at that rally? John Boehner, Mike Pence, and a dozen or so other top Republicans. They were authenticating, validating, embracing a Tea Party that was driven by extreme paranoia, I think a degree of racism, tribalism, and Boehner wanted to ride that tiger to the speakership, which he ended up doing. So, and then you can go forward to the Palin rallies of 2008, the 2008 campaign.
Wait, before you get there, I want to turn to George H.W. Bush. Do you see that as a real turning point in the terms of tone of the country?
Well, you know, he claimed he wanted to be kinder and gentler, right? But yet, his campaign against Michael Dukakis, which is all about challenging his patriotism because he belonged to the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, and because he had a, you know, a legalistic opposition to, or he didn't support the move to say the Pledge of Allegiance in schools because there was a legal challenge to it. I mean, that's all it was. I mean, his campaign, you know, run by Lee Atwater, with the help of Roger Ailes, was not kinder and gentler. It was playing on people's fears that Dukakis was a foreign element, didn't understand America, wasn't a true patriot. I mean, it was, you know, weak stuff compared to what Trump has said. But at the time, roundly considered to be a mean-spirited, in-the-mud campaign with absolutely no substance. And then, what, you know, an interesting story in the book about George H.W. Bush is that this is a guy who, in 1988, during the primary, when he was trying to get the Republican nomination, Pat Robertson was running. And Pat Robertson, you know, the televangelist who had said lots of crazy things about nuclear war and believing that God would send meteors to strike, you know, Disney World because it had a gay pride day, you know, all these sort of things, very far right, believed that only Christians should really serve in the government. You know, he lost. But while during that campaign, Bush met a Robertson supporter while he was campaigning, and the person wouldn't shake his hand. Bush said, you know, when this is all over, we're all going to be on the same side and working together. And the woman would not shake his hand. And he wrote in his diary that evening how disturbing this was to him, that he thought there was a fanaticism being brought into the party by Pat Robertson and like-minded elements, and he even shared his concern with Ronald Reagan at one of their weekly lunches. So that was in 88. Here he is concerned. And then he runs this, you know, terribly muddy campaign against Michael Dukakis that really lowers the level of political discourse in the country. And then shortly after the 88 election, Pat Robertson forms the Christian Coalition. And the Republican Party embraces it. They give money to it. They attend its conferences because they see that he has people, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people signing up who can work for the Republicans and give money to the Republicans and vote for Republicans. So this relationship ends up becoming quite ludicrous. In 1991, Pat Robertson puts out a book. It's called The New World Order. The book is nothing but conspiracy theories of the ages, going back to the Illuminati, the Masons, and he has, you know, and he says that for centuries, there's been a secret cabal of secret societies that have colluded with communists, occultists, and business interests, including now the Federal Reserve, the Trilateral Commission, J.P. Morgan, Henry Kissinger, and it's to impose a one-world collectivist dictatorship upon the entire globe. And this is a satanic plot. And he means it literally. This is to serve Lucifer, he says. And one of the people who is helping this satanic scheme is George H.W. Bush. He names him as an accomplice to this cabal. So here's this book. It sells hundreds of thousands of copies. It has a lot of anti-Semitism in it as well because he identifies the Rothschild family as being a key part of this satanic cabal. It becomes a bestseller. And months later, the Christian Coalition holds its annual conference. And who speaks? George H.W. Bush. He attends the conference and salutes Pat Robertson for all the great work he's doing. I mean, this is a guy, Robertson, who is fueling the worst paranoia out there. This is QAnon stuff of the day. And the Republican Party is thanking him, helping him to raise money, and wrapping its arms around him.
Now a quick break. Hi, it's Diane. Join me for my next book club event, a conversation with Sheila Johnson. She's co-founder of BET, all about her memoir, Walk Through Fire. That's coming up Wednesday, April 24th at 6 p.m. Eastern. Find out more. Register at dianeweem.org/bookclub. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine and an analyst for MSNBC. His new book is American Psychosis. David, what's your takeaway of the Clinton years?
Yeah, the Clinton years, again, we saw this outburst of right-wing conspiracy theory. Vince Foster, Whitewater, and other things. Now, you know, as a liberal writer, I had a lot of policy criticisms and some political criticisms of the Clintons, and even of some of their wheeling and dealing. You know, there was legitimate concerns, but you saw Rush Limbaugh and other right wing media. This was the rise of Fox during these years, putting out one Clinton conspiracy after another. The most bold one being that the Clintons had killed dozens, not one or two, Diane, but dozens of their political opponents and people who had crossed them over the years. And Jerry Falwell, still active, still a big part of the Republican coalition, is out there selling a video describing this conspiracy that the Clintons had killed people. It was called the Clinton Chronicles. Rush Limbaugh is spreading this junk. And the Republicans are welcoming Rush Limbaugh as an honorary member of the House class of 94, 95. They're going on his show again and again and again. And he is the leader in some ways of the Republican Party. And then at the same time, you had the rise of this these anti-government militias. Remember them? That were complete far-right militia extremists. And you had members of the Republican Party who were cheering them on. And when the FBI and the Justice Department wanted to sort of start looking at what they were doing and whether there are any laws being violated, tried to prevent them from doing that. And that included Newt Gingrich and Senator Robert Dole. At one point, the NRA, National Rifle Association, another big part of the Republican coalition at that point in time, they were on their bulletin board. Their members were placing recipes on how to make bombs and talking about this, how to prepare for the Civil War to come and how to attack the government. The Republicans were attending these conferences, the NRA conventions, and taking lots of money from them and working with them. And when the NRA put out a fundraiser calling federal agents jackbooted thugs who wear Nazi bucket helmets, again, sort of justifying and reinforcing the paranoia about black helicopters and anti-government activity, the Republicans went along with this. George H.W. Bush, who was an honorary member of the NRA, actually at that point submitted his resignation. He left the NRA. No other Republican did that.
So all of this leads us to Trump, or that someone like him was actually inevitable if you're following your drift.
There's been this dark side of the Republican Party. You know, Mitt Romney embraced Donald Trump when Trump was a birther. This dark side that has always reached out and encouraged and exploited, you know, far-right paranoia, bigotry, tribalism, and extremism. Always there. It doesn't define the Republican Party in total. Richard Nixon created the EPA, went to China. I mean, Republican Party has done other things. But it's always has been there since World War II. So Trump came along, and he just decided not to do it on the slide, that he could make this front and center. And he has embraced QAnon. He's embraced more conspiracy theories than you and I can count. And he has made the conspiracy theory that the election was stolen from him the central cause of the Republican Party now. He's placed it right in the middle. And if you don't agree with this, you get excommunicated. And he has, you know, often the problem with flaming extremism is that it can lead to violence. And he did that quite readily and willingly, led to January 6th, a day in which he then did nothing to stop the violence. So he took this playbook and he just, like, you know, juiced it up.
Do you now see him, as many have said, as a threat to democracy, or are the forces that have been there for all these years, with or without Trump, the greater threat?
That's a great point, and that gets to, I think, to the heart of the issue. You know, Trump is one guy, right? Joe McCarthy was one guy. You know, it's very hard for one person on his or her own to move a nation or change a nation unless there are people who will follow, right? So what McCarthy tapped, an unease and a paranoia and insecurity that was, you know, that was rampant throughout the land. He didn't make people be afraid of things. He exploited their fear and unease. He did it rather well. And Trump does the same thing. He's out there, you know, playing off people's grievances, resentments. He knows that people that, you know, not a majority, but that tens of millions of Americans are susceptible to his paranoid ravings about a deep state, and his spin and his gaslighting and his disinformation. So, you know, if he went out there and said all these things and people said, nah, nah, not going to buy it, it wouldn't work. But usually when a president loses an election and loses both houses of Congress, the party says, thank you very much, you know, see you later. And they kick him to the curb. Look at, you know, the Democrats and Jimmy Carter.
But that's not what's happening.
No, the opposite has happened here. And his loss has become the lost cause of the Republican Party because, not because this is what Mitch McConnell wants, because Mitch McConnell sees that there are millions at the Republican base have, you know, moved in this extreme direction. That's why I call the book American Psychosis. They believe things that are not true, which makes it very hard to deal with them, because if someone believes something that's not true, you can't necessarily reason them out of it or have an honest debate with them. They believe things that are not true. And Trump is exploiting that, as are the Trumpers within the party.
But how about some of the primaries that we've seen, which would indicate that not all of his supporters are still voting his way?
Well, you know, the primaries are a mixed bag for Trump. Someone like Doug Mastriano, who is a QAnon-ish election denier, won the primary for governor in Pennsylvania.
And Sarah Palin lost.
Right? And so you have both ends of this. But you have in Arizona, Carrie Lake and Mark Fincham, who is a QAnon election denier, you know, above all, that who won the primary for Secretary of State, and he will control elections in Arizona should he win the election. So right now, Trumpism, you know, is still, I think, very, very powerful within the Republican coalition. And if you look at polling numbers, a majority of Republicans side with Trump on election denialism and still want to see him run again. It's not everyone, and his approval rating amongst Republicans is still in the high 80s, low 90s. So, you know, Trumpism is not going away. I don't see there's a lane for non-Trumpers within the party. Look what happened to Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. The 10 Republicans who voted for impeachment in the House are goners. They either left or they've been defeated.
But a lot has come out since then, including the January 6th hearings.
Right.
And those have been watched by a great many people. Do you think that those are perhaps changing any minds?
I think they're having a marginal effect, but I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I think politics turns on the margins now. I think there are very, very, very few persuadable American voters out there.
Really?
And I think that in general, you know, the Republicans, you know, the, you know, 30%, 20%, whatever you want to call it, of Americans who are with Trump are with Trump. And they're not going to be changed by, their attitudes are not going to be changed by the hearings.
Do you think he's going to run again?
I think he wants to at this point. I think he is afraid of running again and losing, although we'll have the same replay of 2020 all over again. So I think, you know, all things being equal, he probably will. I've written this for years now, 7, 8, 9 years, I've been writing that the three things that motivate Trump the most are revenge, revenge, and revenge. And he has said that. He said that his number one rule of business is if someone screws you, you screw them back. Not one time over, 5 times over, 10 times over. Spite and revenge, I think, are his inner psychological core. And so I think this is what makes it particularly dangerous. Should he come back, or even if Republicans, Trump Republicans, win control of the House, the investigations, the use of federal power, they will do everything to get the people who they identify as their enemies.
And so Trump, how worried are you?
I worry that the Republican Party doesn't exist anymore to pursue policy, to have policy debates. It exists to gain power and power of service to Trump or Trumpism should he not run again. And that, to me, is a dangerous moment for American democracy, because I don't think they prioritize preserving democracy, and they want to rig elections. They want to put people in charge of elections who will deny them on the basis of nothing. We still have no evidence of anything going wrong in 2020. And yet they still claim, Marjorie Taylor Greene, again, the other day, that the election was stolen. Where, I keep saying, where's the evidence? Rudy Giuliani told Rusty Bowers, the Republican House Speaker in the legislature out there, Bowers testified to this January 6th committee, that they had no evidence. They had theories and they had notions and ideas and feelings. So a party that is driven by those forces that, you know, looks at January 6th and says no big deal, and that still supports the fellow who incited January 6th, but I think even more importantly, who did nothing to save and protect and defend the Constitution on January 6th, that party represents a threat if these are their values.
David Corn, I want to thank you for being with us. Congratulations on the book. How long did it take you to write?
I try to compact the pain of writing books, compress the pain. So I did it in a little over a year, but it was 17 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was a lot of material and it was a great, you know, educational experience for me. And I think I hope it really gives people some understanding of how we got to the moment we are now, particularly as we're discussing the hold that MAGA extremism has on the Republican Party and whether or not Trump is leading it in the direction of semi-fascism, or as I prefer to call it, authoritarianism.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was David Corn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine and analyst for MSNBC. His new book is American Psychosis, an historical investigation of how the Republican Party went crazy. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Thanks for listening, all. Back with you next week. I'm Diane Reed.